a most original and creative talent in our business. Would you welcome Mr. Orson Welles?
Ladies and gentlemen, Orson Welles again, come to call for another visit.
Good evening. This is Orson Welles.
Buck Benny, the two-fisted, quick-triggered marksman who shoots from the hip and never misses.
Well, hello again. This is Buck Benny speaking. Welcome to another episode of Orson Welles podcast. We have Orson Welles commentaries. This is the second episode that deals with the blinded black man that we dealt with last time. I'm trying to remember his name. Woodard is his last name. What's his first name again?
Isaac.
That's right. Yeah. And anyway, well, let's get into that. It's an interesting episode. If you notice, this episode seems a little, quite a bit less impactful than the last one. I will just tell you, the next one is going to be just an amazing tour de force from Orson. And we'll get to that as well for next week. But let's focus on this one. Kind of changes direction, kind of doesn't focus as much on Woodard, and the whole beginning part is not about that, and then slides into that. Vincent, what did you take away from this episode?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, this episode does seem a little less impactful, although I think that the content with Woodard, I would argue, is still pretty good. However, one of the reasons this episode suffers is because of how much Welles talks and so quickly and name drops a ton of things that he doesn't explain. So I will say, preemptively, I hope we can come back and, maybe go through those a little bit, talk more about issues like the veto and some people that he mentions. But, for my part, I am going to focus on the, Woodard section. One might think that Welles's proclamation last episode would get a ton of newspaper coverage, and some newspapers claimed that it did. The New York Times the following week said, oh, it's covered in a lot of northern newspapers, suggesting that it wasn't covered in the South very much. Though in my own quick research, I didn't seem to get that at all. Most of the newspaper coverage with Welles and Woodard didn't actually include Woodard at all. It was Welles's Around the World was closing this week. And so it was a lot of that. It was a lot about his film. Welles had started a one-man show at the Copacabana, so people covered that. There was a couple articles about this case in particular, but they focused largely on Aiken and not about Woodard at all. And I think that's why this episode ends up, Welles does what he needs to do. And so I'll paint a couple pictures on that. So as you'll listen to the episode, Aiken like boycotts, the mayor writes in and says, here's an affidavit from me and my police chief, wasn't us. Well, the city of Aiken was really upset, as Terry mentioned last week, but I didn't realize how upset and how far down this went. A lot of the newspaper articles interviewed people at like the Lions Club and all these like groups in Aiken and said, this is disrespectful. Welles needs to apologize. This didn't happen in Aiken. The city council also passed an order saying that all Welles films need to be banned and the posters need to be burned. And so the city police got all the posters for a Welles film that was showing. I believe it was, I wrote it down. It was a smaller one. He just appears in it. Tomorrow is Forever. It's Welles and Claudette Colbert. Welles is a World War I veteran that returns 20 years after the war, and he's had face surgery and he's unrecognizable and his wife is married to someone else. Anyways, it's a smaller film, but they burn this, they make a big show out of it. And so, the other thing is that Aiken doesn't acknowledge Woodard's story at all. No one cited says, oh, how horrible this is. They say Aiken has been, Welles did Aiken a disjustice. And we need our apology. We need all that. So I think Welles's point about even if Aiken wasn't involved in this, that shouldn't be the focus. So, I think that what Welles is saying is that Aiken's just essentially victim blaming. They're saying that, well, really what the problem is that this victim is messing up some facts, we're paying for it. And Wells said, you should, you know, you need to join the search for this, you know, possibly imposter police officer. But I think the other thing he does is he mentions how the city of Aiken is trying to use authority over this African-American man. Essentially, they're saying, well, our affidavit is from a mayor, from a police chief. And they seem to be suggesting, well, that's far more important than this African-American's affidavit. And I think what Wells says is really important, where he says, even if the Supreme Court and the President of the United States had an affidavit, I still wouldn't ignore these cries. And so I actually think it was rather important that he emphasized that, sure, maybe it wasn't Aiken. And that seems, you know, he's like, oh, I don't know, maybe. But I think he's also not sure it is Aiken. And of course, it doesn't end up being Aiken. And so I think he did the right thing in saying, you know, okay, let's say it's not Aiken, but everybody needs to be as excited about disproving it was Aiken as they are for crusading for this wronged individual and for the rights of all African-Americans. So in that sense, I actually think this episode is really crucial.
Excellent. Kathy, what are your thoughts on it?
Well, I was really struck by this episode was aired August the 4th, 1946. And I was really struck by something, a bygone era of how quiet Washington would be. The Congress was adjourning. Everybody was gone. Everybody was on vacation. If he feels tired, I mean, you know, he just sounds at the beginning of this episode where he's just sort of, as you said, Vincent, sort of running through all this information about his disgust about the accomplishments or not non-accomplishments of the Congress and what the heck is going on with the International Peace Conference and his growing anger as he sees his friends in the Soviet Union turning totalitarian. But I get this real feeling that it's like 100 degrees and hot and there's no air conditioning and everybody's gone. And, you know, that kind of feeling that we almost don't have anymore, living in a world of air conditioning and 24/7 news. So in part, I just really felt like, you know, this is everybody's out of town. I'm the only one around here and I'm depressed and, you know, and this is awful. So it kind of gave me that affect, that emotional feeling of that. And as I said, get that out of the way, and then we'll come back later to actually some interesting possibilities, as well as sort of shifting attitudes in the long and kind of a wearying discussion of current international political events, which he'd stayed away from. You know, that we hadn't had just such a political news dump from him in quite a number of weeks. And so that in itself is kind of interesting if it's kind of boring in that part. I'd like to hear what Terry has to say.
That's what I was thinking. Terry?
Well, I, as you know, I spent much of my adult life as a news reporter. And Kathy, you're right. We do live in a round-the-clock media world today. But once upon a time, if you wanted news, and particularly broadcast news, you expected a certain standard. And today, those standards are, if not completely gone, at least very, very different. And what people consider to be news today is oftentimes analysis or commentary or opinion. And in the case of Orson Welles' commentaries, they were clearly not news, yet they were based on reports of what actually happened. One of the great challenges for a reporter when you have information that later turns out to be inaccurate or at least incomplete is how to acknowledge that. Newspapers traditionally have had have published corrections. Broadcasting is more difficult because, you know, people don't consume radio or television the same way. And for Wells, I think it was a huge challenge to confront this mistake. He made an error. He identified the wrong town based on the affidavit, which also erroneously identified Aiken and not Batesburg, where the attack really took place. And so Wells was defending his reputation and trying to make the point that it didn't matter where it happened. But of course, facts do matter, because as we know, if you make a mistake, people will not only argue about that, but they will doubt the veracity of everything you say. And I think that's what happened to Wells in this case. He was being undermined by an error, not of his own making, but an error that he repeated. And now he's digging in, you know, and saying, well, it didn't matter where it happened. And here we are all these years later, still confronting the issues, the underlying issues that led to this horrible incident. But again, confronting the phenomenon of credibility. Did people believe Orson Welles? He wasn't a reporter. He was an actor. He was a producer. He was a writer. But he was also a political commentator. And did people at that time believe him? And I suppose just as today, it depended on where in the country you were and what your background was and what your point of view was. I feel great sympathy for Orson Welles. And he was, you know, he was not a trained journalist, but he had a lot of those sensibilities. He tried to be, it seems to me anyway, he tried to be accurate in what he said. But mostly he was a storyteller. And I think just as today, what people say matters, the accuracy of what people say matters, but if you compare it to historical stories, biblical stories, and before, I think it's also important to take the stories as stories. And what can we learn from this story? And of course, if you're upset by the story, by the point of the story, then it's harder to appreciate the value of the, you know, the lesson. And we are able to do that all these years later, even though we know that racism is still alive and thriving in America and in the world. And even though people's credibility is challenged all the time. So I have sympathy for Orson Welles for the spot he was in for making this mistake. And we'll see going forward that he confronts this a bit more. But here we are again. Who do you believe? Who do you trust?
Yeah, Terry, I just want to say that I think in some ways, unlike the city of Aiken, I'm glad there was this mistake, because it gave Wells an opportunity to call out inaction, right? Because if he had said the right city, Batesburg, you know, probably would have been an investigation. But from what he seems to insinuate, the city of Aiken would have done nothing. They would have been uninterested. And he's saying that, look at all of the action you're taking against me right now, and go take it out on racism. And go figure out what happened, because regardless of what city it was, this person was blinded because of racial violence.
Yeah.
Go figure it out.
You make a good point, Vincent. That said, we also have to try to put ourselves in the shoes of people who lived in Aiken. And for them, it was horrible because, you know, they weren't guilty. They didn't do this. But you're right. True. You're right. It emphasized the problem. You're absolutely right.
Right.
And I'm kind of interested, us looking back and sort of, because sometimes during these broadcasts, I just get the sense that Orson is saying, is there anybody out there? Is there anybody listening to me? And we've wondered about that, not exactly having been able to find reliable ratings information and knowing that it's a Sunday at 1 o'clock. And so, you know, in a way, this big sort of the hullabaloo that Aiken is choosing to make is another window into, oh, people were listening. And even if they're blowing, Aiken is blowing it way out of proportion in their, you know, a supposed injured pride, it is one way to go, wow, you know, that's, even though this show doesn't have a sponsor, you know, anymore, that, you know, it's out there and people are listening to it. So,
yeah, it doesn't seem the at least the mayor of Aiken, though, listened to it, because he demanded from ABC a transcription of the broadcast because he had just heard people complaining, you know, about Aiken. So, you know, it's possible somebody either listened down there and told him, or it just made its way down from, you know the northern stations, who knows?
Sure. Although I found it playing in Atlanta, you know, I mean, if you look for, if you do the deep dive in newspapers.com, you can find the show listed in quite a few Southern papers. I was kind of surprised that they, but indeed the show is only going to be on the air, what, another 4 weeks? It's going to end in September. So indeed, ABC is going to be chicken and pull the plug on it in just a few weeks from now.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Well, and I kind of, in my brain, kind of hope that our politicians are pretty busy doing things. And so they wouldn't maybe have time to listen to a show like this if they're doing their job and everything. So they would have to go back and get a transcript of it or something. The other thing I was thinking as Terry was talking is, if this was today, what would we, and Twitter existed back then, I mean, what would you have gotten out there? I'm sure you would have people say, well, obviously Orson doesn't know what he's talking about. And I've heard the guy was already blind anyway, or his left eye didn't work right. And, you know, what are you going to do? But, or you're going to have some quack doctor somewhere say, I looked at him and I could tell he was blind far before this time ever happened. And, you know, it's crazy. All the folks who get out of the woodwork now when there's any kind of story like this that will just say it's not true and it couldn't happen that way. And Aiken focusing on, well, that couldn't possibly happen in our city, and it didn't, you see. And so we're not responsible in any way, and we're completely different, and that wouldn't happen here. And it's like they lose the whole focus on it. And Orson's trying to bring that up, but I honestly don't think Orson is the guy to do it at that point. I think it's other people should have stepped in on other radio shows and said, wait a minute, we've looked into this. This is true. And I don't know. I don't know if there was
We don't exactly know, since Orson got his information from the NAACP folks, you know, we, without a paper record or knowing, so we don't know how much he's being in touch with them.
Right.
You know, so we don't, there's a whole backstory that indeed we could do more research and see what's being published in the black press and other kinds of things to say Orson is, even though I love the fact that he says, I've sent investigators down there. Like, good for you, Orson. So, but it's possible that he is in contact with other people learning more about this. I know.
So he was sorry, Kathy. I did do a little bit of research on the investigations of this that were happening. I mean, there's two things going on. One is that another reason that in some ways Aiken was so hurt was that Aiken called Washington, and they were saying, like, can you prove that this was Aiken? And they said, all we can prove at this point, it happens later that it gets disproven that it was Aiken, is that it happened between Greensboro, South Carolina, and Augusta, Georgia. And so they were like basically like saying, we can't disprove it, but we are sending investigators down to try to figure it out. And so the FBI did get involved, and eventually they will exonerate Aiken before, of course, they make any claim on Woodard himself, but that will happen later. But the other thing that is happening in the black press is that the black press is trying to make it clear that this is not an isolated occurrence. And so there's other reports. I'm looking at this one article right now where they mention Woodard, and they talk about how they really blame the War Department of the United States for these issues and their lack of caring, and they call it their impotence, because they talk about how the War Department is not even protecting veterans or when they're in the military. There's tons of racial violence there. But then they specifically talk about how they just put their hands up as soon as they're discharged. And so the War Department's official stance on Isaac Woodard was, well, he was discharged hours before, and so we have no, you know, we have no jurisdiction. We're not investigating this. And so, you know, I think that's where they would say, you know, there's just a ton of people like Aiken saying, well, we had nothing to do with this. It's not our problem. The other thing that's getting reported, we talked about last week, is the benefit for Isaac Woodard in New York City in particular. And we asked if Wells attended The answer is it's unclear. Wells's official statement with Frank Sinatra, who he was good friends with, was that they were trying to clear their schedules. So I don't know if they made it or not. It was largely attended by New York City politicians and particularly African-American stars like Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Pearl Bailey, and the whole gamut of them. So I'm unclear if Wells also went.
Well, and the other piece that I was thinking about this was, if this did happen today, you could definitely see how Fox would be covering it one way and MSNBC would cover it in a totally different way. It's just sad that you can totally see how it would play out today. And certain folks would be making a big deal about the fact that Orson was wrong with that.
There's one other aspect to this larger issue about how not just African Americans, but all members of the military are treated, mistreated, not cared for.
Yeah.
The rest of this commentary focused on the peace talks. And there's a cartoon that Wells refers to, which was published in the London Daily Herald in 1920, of the Big Four, Wilson, David Lloyd George, that is Woodrow Wilson, David Lloyd George, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, George Clemenceau, the Prime Minister of France, and Vittorio Orlando, the leader of Italy. And they're pictured looking, this is from, excuse me, they're pictured, these were the leaders of the 1919 peace talks in Versailles. And they are pictured hearing a child weeping. And this is under the banner Peace and Future Cannon Fodder. And the child is weeping because he's the 1940 generation, grows up to be the 1940 generation of soldiers who will become cannon fodder, who will die in the Second World War. And proportionately, of course, members of of the armed forces, particularly minorities, and especially in the United States, African Americans have a disproportionately large number of wounded and killed in conflicts. But the commentary that Wells makes is, you know, we created World War II by how badly we ended World War I.
Right.
And he also talks about the World Court and the American refusal to give up a veto power. And, you know, here we are all these years later, we still don't allow the World Court with the International Criminal Court to have authority over Americans. But the question of who is suffering the most in wars, of course, everybody suffers, civilians suffer, but proportionately, again, it's African Americans who bear the brunt of the casualties.
Yeah, definitely.
This is the episode Wells seems like he believes peace is not coming. I feel like in the past, he's always been like, oh, you got to do this. We got to be working together. In this episode, he seems like totally disillusioned, like it's not happening anymore. I don't see it happening, you know, for many reasons. He doesn't just blame the United States. He also is, I think, getting a clearer sense that Russia is not here to be nice. And so, you know, some of his sort of core beliefs about the possibility of peace, that Russia is not an antagonist, although he always has said they've been, you know, loosely preparing. I think he now sees the veto power in particular as bringing up the clarity that this isn't going to happen.
Exactly. So you all are making such smart comments. We remember back broadcasts ago, back in like April of 1946, when Orson was criticizing Winston Churchill for talking about the Iron Curtain that was falling in Eastern Europe. And here, August 4th, just about, what is that, April, May, June, July, you know, I mean, 4 months later, he's seeing it in action. And his willingness to give the Soviets a pass, you know, as in he felt that their actions were honorable and they too were trying to maintain peace. He's really turning. You know, I mean, he's really changing his opinion. And I heard him say a lot more sort of aggressive criticisms of lack of democracy, that totalitarianism and sort of military takeovers was happening. So again, as part of my my ideal that I'm teaching an entire course on the incredible year of 1946, this would be such a great guide for it. And one bit of hope in the whole episode was when Orson talks about some member of Congress who had an idea for an international student exchange.
Oh, yeah.
To send 1,000 U.S. students to all these European countries, yeah, and send 1,000 European students back here. How I wish that would have happened. I wonder if that's connected to what eventually became the Fulbright Scholar Exchange. But it was one little bit of hope. And I was sorry to hear that it was simply filibustered out of existence. But
well, and maybe a little connected to the Peace Corps, huh?
Yeah.
Yes. So
that's excellent. I just want to brag on myself this week. I because this ties in a little bit, and I don't know else to mention, so I'm going to mention it. I have been thinking about doing something for 2 years and or more, and haven't done it. And my friend Bob, who's on my other podcast, just kicked me in the rear and said, "You need to get this done. Just do it this week." And I told him I'd do it this month. But I ended up doing it the next day after I talked with him. I sat down with my 94-year-old dad and taped it and created a recording, because I don't know how much longer he's going to be with us. And he talked all about the end of World War II, how he almost went into World War II, but didn't. He'd done his physical and everything, but they didn't ship him over. And then his whole experience of going into the Korean War. And I just thought that tied in a little bit to how we can be so thankful. We talk about things, how things haven't changed and so forth, and a lot of things have a run through. But I think Orson probably would have been surprised that we'd make it to today and still not have a third world war, because that did change. We've had a lot of other wars, but we've had a lot of other things, issues and so forth, but at least we haven't had a world war, and maybe the next world war would end the world, and that's why we don't have it. But that's a plus. Hearing my dad talk, I have 2 hours now that I recorded him, and I'm going to do some follow-up things. But it's just one of those things where if I hadn't done it and he was gone, I'd be kicking myself for the rest of my life, going, I should have done what, because I mean, I do these podcasts all the time. I have tons of people on. I mean, I should be able to talk to my dad. So it was really nice. Anyway, I think we'll end this there because we have another one to do. Are we good with that? An enjoyable episode, certainly worth listening to. Certainly covers a lot of ground. Just know at the beginning, there'll be a lot of ground covered. And then he'll get to as a quarter at the end. And that's good ground too. I think the whole thing's great. But you know, if you miss this week, whatever you end up doing, make sure you listen to next week's, because next week's is just another one of those powerhouse shows that I think is probably one of the top two or three that Orson's done this whole time. So, and we'll cover that right now, and you guys will hear it next week. So see you next time.
Hello, this is Orson Welles speaking. On his way to the peace conference in Paris, Mr. Clement Attlee, the Prime Minister of Britain, remembered a cartoon he'd seen 25 years before in the London Daily Herald. It showed the big four of 1919, Wilson and Lloyd George, Clemenceau and Orlando, walking out of the peace conference of 1919, having written the Treaty of Versailles, and Clemenceau had stopped the others. Curious, the old lion was saying. Curious. I seem to hear a child crying. The cartoon, Mr. Attlee remembered, showed a child, a weeping child, labeled in a bitterly wonderful moment of prophecy, Class of 1940. We're very glad that the Prime Minister of Britain had not forgotten the cartoon. We hope he never does. We suggest that a few copies be struck off for distribution among the peacemakers of 1946. Mr. Molotov and Mr. Burns would be well advised to decorate their shaving mirrors with that picture of the weeping child. We cannot think of a better way for them to start their day. Stalin's Yalta promise to democratize Eastern Europe was broken in Bucharest the week after it was made. The Soviet Empire is already reaching from Finland to the borders of Greece, and the Grand Alliance of the so-called democracies of the West has long since ceased to be a mere diplomatic threat as the politicos haggle away another summer on such issues as the two-thirds voting procedure. That Grand Alliance looms over the arguments as a blunt political fact. The United States and the Soviet Union, it turns out, are going to stand together on the broad question of the veto. Borders will be disputed, but the main border is past dispute. The borderline of a divided world shows black enough for the least observant of the observers to spell it out of the headlines. Blocks versus majorities, the big powers versus the small. These are matters for 1,000 editorials today, but most folks who follow the news, even in the most casual sandwich of comic strips, know what time of day it is. And perhaps even the diplomats have taken note that this, in very truth, is the 11th hour. Take me to the Luxembourg Palace, said the newspaper man, according to his own dispatch. To the palace, of course, said the cab driver, where you're all busy preparing for the next war. Collective security, the one world of Roosevelt and Wilkie and Litvinov, are the ashes of dreams. Empires expand and shrink. Borders are pushed back and forth over the hapless heads of the peoples of Europe. The Russian half of our poor little globe is an armed camp. America has defaulted as champion of the freedoms. In foreign policy, Roosevelt's party is playing the Republican game, and Britain's Labour Party is dancing the old dance of death, while the old Tory idea, the Tory ignorance and Tory cowardice, call the tune. Curious. I seem to hear a child crying. No, I'm afraid the Palace of Luxembourg is more likely to be remembered in ages hence as the place where Tom Paine wrote The Age of Reason. Along the Potomac, the dawn rose quiet and cool. Around the floor of the Senate, tired colored men were bent over the worn carpet, picking up the refuse left behind by the 79th Congress of the United States. Among the Senate porters, more than one must have muttered, "Good riddance." And as he swept thoughtfully beneath the seats of Senator Bilbo and Senator Eastland, the gentleman from Mississippi, he must have dreamt a happy little dream of someday putting that broom of his to more effective service in the hygiene of the United States Senate. This Sunday in Washington is as dead a Sunday as was ever known in Zion, Illinois. Even the White House is empty. Mr. Harry Truman is down in Missouri in the hopes of stifling a human roadblock named Roger Slaughter, a congressman of Kansas City. Some people think Mr. Truman ought to stay out of local politics. Others think he never should have left local politics. State Department's like a tomb. Mr. Jimmy Burns is in Paris. Mr. Dean Acheson sits in his Maryland farm today, licking a few wounds. The undersecretary took a bad beating during the last few hours of the 79th Congress. Well, maybe he didn't take them personally. You and I and the family next door, we're all a little black and blue. For one thing, it was a little matter of a world court. Oregon Senator Morse moved that the Senate vote a treaty accepting jurisdiction of the new world court in all international cases. In other words, the treaty said, we will not only join the court, but will abide by its decisions. We will not hold out a veto power on whether or not we would play ball if we thought the decisions would go against us. This veto power is what Burns is opposing in Paris now, and Baruch is fighting in New York. Of all the opponents of the veto power, the most enthusiastic is that triumvirate of statesmen, Tom Connolly, Arthur Vandenberg, and John Foster Dulles. Mr. Dulles, in his wisdom, has decided that he doesn't like the possible compulsory decisions of the World Court. Mr. Dulles, it seems, wants the United States to have a veto power in the court. This, mind you, is the identical Mr. Dulles who writes those nice long articles in Life magazine calling for war on Russia because the Bolsheviks, those unreasoning savages of the East, refuse in their oriental ignorance to give up the veto power. This is the same Mr. Dulles who drafts some reservations to the World Court Bill. Reservations. Do you know what that word means, reservations? Does it ring a bell somewhere in the back of your mind? Does it strike an unpleasantly familiar chord in your memory of other peace conferences? Reservations? That's precisely the word used by the Honorable Mr. Henry Cabot Lodge when he fought the League of Nations in 1920. Reservations. We killed the League with reservations. The reservations of Mr. Dulles were rendered up in legislative form to his favorite senator, Mr. Vandenberg. These reservations were introduced in turn by Mr. Vandenberg to the Senate. Against these reservations, Mr. Morse battled with stubborn persistence and a stout heart, but to no avail. Up stands the gentleman from Texas, Mr. Connolly, and backs up a queer, gray, formless object known as bipartisan foreign policy. And the result, we have approved the World Court Treaty with reservations. What does that mean, Daddy? It means we have the veto power. Isn't that nice, Daddy? Does that mean the other countries have the veto power? Certainly not. The veto power is like the atom bomb. It's very dangerous if anybody else has it. Memo for the U.S. Mint. Put a new motto on the penny. In us, we trust. Curious. I seem to hear a child cry. What do you say to sending 1,000 American students to every major country of Europe and sending 1,000 of their students here? All those thousands and thousands of young people multiplied by the friends they're bound to make ought to make it a little more imperative for the governments of the world to get along together in a sensible climate of good fellowship. I don't mean the students could do it all by themselves, but they could do their bit. Well, there was a bill providing for such a worldwide exchange. Tom Connolly allowed that the $10 million it called for was just another case of foolish spending, but the friends of the bill finally got the elder statesman to see it their way, and it would have been put to a yea or nay if Lister Hill of Alabama hadn't asked the gentleman from Texas if he would yield. Well, Sir Tom yielded, and Lister Hill took off on an hour's oration concerning the defenses of Pearl Harbor. This gave Tom time to talk to some other thinkers and to remember his train reservations home. Tom didn't want to lose those reservations. There goes that word again, reservations. By the time the senator from Alabama finished his address, that fine exchange project was just another matter for the dustbin of the 79th Congress of the United States of America. And yet, you know, out of all this stupid blundering and floundering, this awful mess, more than a few good bills have been born. Congress is a right confusing thing to watch. Fair estimate of any Congress is hard to come by. This 79th Congress, just for example, the same Congress that scuttled full employment, that failed to pass an anti-lynch bill or to destroy the poll tax, is the Congress that surprised even itself and passed Bretton Woods and the United Nations Charter. Yes, the same Congress that went on that strike-breaking binge of recent and unhappy memory, the same Congress that let the OPA wither and die, increased appropriations for the sick and needy, and passed a much better than decent bill for the control of atomic energy. Almost its last accomplishment belongs on the credit side of the ledger. The La Follette-Monroney bill, for which we've beaten a couple of drums in this program, is now law. It reorganizes Congress itself and brings the machinery of lawmaking to a point of efficiency that's almost up to date. Because of this bill, the 80th Congress will find itself in many respects a new kind of organization. And the congressmen of the 80th Congress themselves are going to be a little better paid. That ought to mean that fewer of our representatives will suffer in the future from Andy May's kind of heart trouble. All in all, we've had a lot of disappointments this year from Washington, but the good word is that our brand of democracy is still in working order and open for business. Last week, I read you an affidavit from a Negro soldier named Isaac Woodward. May you remember that he was taken off a bus in South Carolina by a policeman and beaten until he was blinded in both eyes. I have before me a letter from Mr. H. Odell Weeks, who, it seems, is the mayor of the city of Aiken in the state of South Carolina, where, according to the soldier's affidavit, he was blinded. The mayor encloses affidavits of his own, sworn to by the city recorder, by the city chief of police, and by a couple of patrol officers. Now, these gentlemen deny all knowledge of the incident. It is indeed unfortunate, writes Mr. Weeks. And these are his exact words, quote, that you did not fully verify this story before you broadcasted it, unquote. The mayor goes on to say that since my broadcast went out to the nation, and since, according to the affidavits, the locale of the story was wholly untrue, he, the mayor, urges that I have the courage and forthrightness to retract the wrong I have done his city, giving to my own retraction the same emphasis I placed upon the original broadcast. Well, Mr. Weeks, I hardly know how to make affidavits of your city recorder and city policeman as emphatic as Mr. Woodward's in the hospital for the blind. If it turns out to be true that the city of Aiken is blameless of this hideous scandal, it is my duty to make that innocence as public as possible, and I hope to be able to. But I must warn you that denials are never dramatic, and if I'm to say something exciting about Aiken, it will have to be something better than that a Negro boy was never blinded in its streets. I look forward to giving the subject of Aiken all the emphasis it deserves, but I'm bound to fail without some affirmative material. There are thousands of cities where Negro soldiers have not been blinded. I hope it will be my privilege to announce that your city is one of these. But since the broadcast is going to go out, as you put it, to the nation, let's spice up the retraction with a little good news. I won't ask you what the city of Aiken has done for Negro soldiers or for Negroes or for the blind. I'll only ask you if you're willing to join with me in a manhunt. A man dressed as a policeman blinded a discharged veteran. The blinded boy swears that his tormentor told him he came from the Aiken police. It is surely a more urgent matter for you to apprehend this imposter before he commits further outrages in your city's name than it is to exact from a commentator the cold comfort of apology. You'll get the apology when the facts are clear. Until then, you must understand why it must be deferred. After all, Mr. Weeks, I have not only the affidavits of your policeman, I have also the affidavit of the blinded soldier. Working on the meager clue that there is also an Aiken County, I've sent investigators there and to your city. Who should bring out the truth, unless it is too skillfully hidden? The soldier might easily have made a mistake, but there's a man in a policeman's uniform who made a worse mistake. And all the retractions in the world won't cleanse the name of Aiken till we find that man. I assure you, Mr. Weeks, I do not doubt the word of your police chief, your patrol officers, your city recorder, but neither do I doubt the word of the blinded Negro boy. His suffering gives his oath a special validity, and I would take it against the Supreme Court and the President of the United States. Let us say he misunderstood what was said to him, or let us say he was lied to. But just saying that isn't enough. Your city's honor is certainly more important than my pride, but honor and pride are piddling trifles beside a pair of eyes. If it is your point that the boy was lied to, it is my point that we must all of us refuse to rest till we've unmasked the liar. If you want me to say that this awful thing did not happen in your city, then there's an American soldier who believes that it did happen in your city. And I cannot forget that. It is to him, Mr. Weeks, that you should address your first and most indignant letters. They will, of course, need to be transcribed in Braille. Now I see my time is just about up. That's all I have to say to you for the moment, Mr. Mayor of Aiken. And you, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming to this part of your dial at this part of a Sunday. Please let me join you next week at the same time and let me hear from you. Your letters are much appreciated. We like reading them on this program. Till next week, then, same time, same station. I remain, as always, obediently yours.
This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.